This is a HeadGum Podcast.
While Andrew and Craig believe the joy of discovery is crucial to enjoying any well-told tale, they will not shy away from spoiling specific story beats when necessary. Plus, these are books you should have read by now.
Welcome to Overdue. It's a podcast about the books you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
My name is Andrew.
Andrew, what do you think the sharpest thing in the world is?
Oh, probably one of those like knives that cuts fish. Fish skin would be hard to cut.
It's
hard to cut.
Yes, fish skin, very hard to cut.
Yeah.
Probably one of those
really fancy nice knives.
Yes. So I Googled this. Shout out to the knife websites out there.
The knife website.
The people selling knives who are like, hey, the sharpest knife is obsidian volcanic glass that you're probably not going to buy because it is also, yes, it's 3 nanometers wide, but it's probably not practical and will break on you because you're a dum-dum. Buy our other sharp knives instead. The other sharpest object is a tungsten needle, which is not a knife, in fact, but a needle.
Right.
With a sharp point that is an atomic... It is one atom in diameter.
That's not very many.
And it can't cut anything. It just shoots electricity at atoms to help us map them.
What is the sharpest thing that is still practical to use as a cutting implement? I guess is the question.
Obsidian, and then like the next, you know, Skyrim material down probably is some sort of very sharp. Like diamond is very
dragon
tough.
Dragon glass.
So we're talking about books on this here book podcast, but I'm being cheeky because, of course, Andrew, what book did you read here on a podcast where each week one of us reads a book and tells the other person about it?
I read Sharp Objects by Gillian Flynn.
Great.
And it's her first book.
Yeah.
But not her best known book because you know what? You can't sharp objects somebody. You can Gone Girl somebody.
You can Gone Girl someone. You can be worried that you're going to get Gone Girled.
Yeah, right.
Who hasn't?
But if I were to say, she Gone Girled me, you would know what had happened to me, basically.
In the same way as if I said I Ocean'd 11'd you.
Yeah, it means you snuck into my vault and you took all my money. And my wife, Tess, as played by Julia Roberts.
That's why he was
If I were to say, she sharp objects me, even if you were really intimately familiar with either the book or the show, which I was not going into this.
It might be confusing.
I don't think you would know exactly what it was that I had done or had done.
Reasonable. Okay, yeah. I'm excited to learn what that could potentially be. But it sounds like it's a little messy. Messier, perhaps, than Gone Girl. You read Gone Girl. Do you remember when you read Gone Girl, Andrew?
On my honeymoon. I also read Handmaid's Tale.
That's right. Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
We covered it on the show, November 2014, episode 87.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we opened it. You can go back and listen. If banger opening, we were talking about Christmas Creep. We are talking about how early we think it is okay to do Christmas in our homes.
Mm-hmm. I don't think my stance on this has changed. December 1st. But I think the more insidious enemy has become Black Friday creep. Because I can go on the Home Depot website on a Tuesday in April and have them tell me that it's spring Black Friday.
No!
We've just completely become unmoored from anything that any words or times could possibly mean. Every sale is Black Friday, everybody.
We need sharp objects, these people.
Yeah, I mean, I was worried about Christmas. I think, I guess I was worried about Christmas creep, but even then, what I probably was worried about was the shopping holiday season creep.
Yeah,
it's gotten so much worse even in our lifetimes.
It was funny to listen to myself talk about Hallmark movies as if it wasn't a thing we'd spent 10 years like dissecting
really
and embracing as a culture.
As much. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The film Gone Girl had recently come out, and we talked a little bit about what happens when you know whether or not there is a spoiler to be had, like a big twist to be, like how that changes your experience.
A movie story. I think I like better than the book because their perspective bothers me less.
Mm, yeah. I like the movie a lot.
You don't have 50 million chances for the main character to think, well, of course I didn't kill my wife like you do in the book.
Yeah. The distancing effect of the camera doing a lot of work there.
Yes.
Also, I just laughed when I was listening to our old podcast together where you said the mind trap when you explained the twist of Gone Girl. You said, haha, mind trap.
It is a mind trap.
It's a mind trap. Go look up mind trap. Good
mind
game.
Trap 2. The challenge continues.
Oh, my good gracious. So you read this book. I'm excited to hear about this debut novel that preceded Gone Girl by 6 years. I'll give us a quick refresher on Flynn. Born in 1971, grew up Kansas City, University of Kansas, worked at a trade magazine for HR professionals in California before going to Northwestern for journalism, started writing for U.S. News and World Report, and then Entertainment Weekly, where I think she was working when she wrote this and Dark Places.
Yeah, I think she has talked needing to take special care when writing sharp objects to like keep it dark and like Southern Gothic-y and not like veer into EW kind of.
Oh yes,
sunniness. Well, yeah.
I found a like not even really an article, but just kind of a blurb in USA Today from 2006.
It's hard to say what to call the words that appear in USA Today.
Well, here's, you know, there's a thing in a quick bio that she loves Friday Night Lights and that she, her own mother is the sweetest person in the world. Quote, I feel like I need to give people a note with the book that says, I'm okay, no worries. Fun fact, this is how it's formatted, Andrew. Fun fact, Flynn, who looks like she's right out of Sex and the City central casting, does not read chick lit. Fun fact.
That is fun. That's a fun fact.
The hardest thing about writing her first novel, quote, maintaining the book's, quote, moist gothic tone, quote, I didn't want it to be EW bouncy.
That's disgusting to describe it as moist and gothic.
I hate it. Awful. So this book, 2006, followed up by Dark Places, 2009, that was made into a movie. I think they're also now going to make that into a TV show that she's going to be.
Was that another one that got made after Gone Girl got made? I feel like people went back and discovered her stuff after Gone Girl, the movie came out.
Teen film, I think. So
yeah, so that's post Gone Girl.
Just post. So I wouldn't have been surprised if it got greenlit before Gone Girl, the film had hit. Mm-hmm. But when we knew Gone Girl, the film was being made.
Yeah.
But I don't know the exact, you know, production history. Gone Girl, the book, 2012. 2014, she writes a short story called The Grown Up, which won an Edgar Award. I think this also won an Edgar Award, Sharp Object.
My name is Edgar, and this is my award. Here you go.
She did write the screenplay for Gone Girl, got herself an Oscar nomination. She has not written a book since Gone Girl. She has written this short story. She wrote the Gone Girl screenplay. She collaborated on a comic book. And I don't mean to be pejorative. It's just when I mean book, I mean novel, fiction, full fiction novel, whatever I'm saying, called Masks in 2015. Mm-hmm. She co-wrote the screenplay for the movie Widows in 2018, starring Viola Davis. And she also was the showrunner for a show called Utopia. You watch more TV than I do. Do you know what that is?
I don't remember Utopia. Yeah, do you have the summary for Utopia pulled up for me somewhere?
I don't. I have the fact that it was originally an HBO Fincher project that she was a part of that fell apart, and then Fincher moved to Netflix, and then Amazon picked it up, and it starred John Cusack. That's all.
Yeah, I don't know what Utopia is.
And she's writing a fourth novel now and working on The Dark Places HBO.
Glad she's on a fourth novel, because I was worried that her novelist, like her run as a novelist, was gone girling us by disappearing abruptly and convincing us that we had killed it.
Yeah, fair enough. Mm-hmm. I think I'll maybe save this. We talked a little bit in the Gone Girl episode. And if you've read anything about Gone Girl, like cultural criticism wise, like you will not be unfamiliar with Gillian Flynn's place as like, I write terrible women characters, like terrible as in they are terrible people.
Yeah.
And you cannot look away from how terrible they are. Mm-hmm. And we collectively as pop culture people spent time and have spent much time talking about whether or not that is quote unquote good representation for feminism, or, you know, there's all sorts of things you can say about that, because she's explicitly writing bad people. So I'll be interested to know how that factors into this book.
Yeah, it's just like, yes, in it, especially for 2006, like in its way, it is radical to write a woman who is allowed to be as big of a jerk.
Yeah,
as
sure.
A lot of men have been allowed to be in literature over the course of many, many decades. At the end of the day, though, it's you've still written somebody who's a bummer.
Sure.
You've still written somebody who's like not fun to spend any time with.
Yeah.
So that kind of defined my read. But yeah, I'm not going to deny the innovation of that, I guess.
Well, and I was reading about a book by film critic Anna Bogatskaya called Unlikable Female Characters that came out last year. And I think it's mostly in TV and film, but just kind of that book sounds fascinating. And if this sounds of interest to you in terms of like how women are portrayed in media, this might be a book that is of interest to you, because she's talking about going back to like Betty Davis and Mae West and like how the Hays Code set us up to like all sorts of, you can't have sympathy for criminals in your movie and stuff like that. And then like, it could be a criminal act to be sexy as a lady and like it, you know, mm-hmm. like just sets up all sorts of weird tropes that we're still, you know, carrying around with us day to day.
Yeah. I guess I'll say there's so many other bad tropes that Flynn is engaging in this book, that the fact that she is kind of pointedly written an unlikable woman,
sure,
is like way in the backseat for me,
yeah,
as a thing
enough.
That I'm thinking about when I think about Camille Preaker.
Camille Preaker.
Camille Preaker.
Okay. Well, I think...
Preakaboo.
What?
I said Preakaboo?
This book was adapted into an HBO miniseries. It was filmed in 2017, premiered in 2018, starred Amy Adams as the main character.
And Susanna had watched it. I had not.
Laura
so
had.
I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about any of the characters or who done it.
Okay.
Going into this, which I think is a thing that we will talk about.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. It was the show was the directed by the same guy, Jean-Marc Vallée, who did Young Victoria, Dallas Buyers Club, Wild, and the miniseries Big Little Lies, which I think I also thought was Sharp Objects. Mm-hmm. There's just that early 2010s. Era of HBO miniseries that all kind of ran, or mid 2010s, I guess, that like ran together for me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I asked Laura the same question. She was like, I liked Gone Girl the movie more than I liked the HBO show. I liked those books just fine. But she liked Gone, you know, she liked them both. But and then I asked her, I was like, do you think you read Sharp Objects before you read Gone Girl? And she was like, probably not.
Yeah.
You had asked me if we thought that people were coming to this book, a lot of folks, because they had read Gone Girl or seen the film. And I did.
I think anecdotally, yeah, a lot of people.
I'd found like a Vulture article that talked about the New York Times didn't even review Sharp Objects. When Gone Girl hit, they then like repackaged the first two books.
Yeah.
You know, the author of, et cetera.
Yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah. Which is totally, it's yeah. like a common thing. And Sharp Objects did fine. Like I did find like a Kirkus review
yeah.
and some other,
oh, yeah.
some other
people
stuff
liked it.
For
yeah.
it that came out in 2006. It just was like not a sensation until people encountered this one thing of Gillian Flynn's, and then they're like, okay, what else? While this lady's hot, what else can we?
For
what
sure.
else can we do to adapt her work?
Well, I would like to know what word was that.
It was like and love coming out of your mouth at the same time, I think.
Check the tape on that one. Uh-huh. Don't let us know what word I just said. Mm-hmm. We'll take a quick break, and then Andrew's going to tell me about how sharp these objects are.
Craig, here on Overdue, we love moms.
We do.
In pretty much every way that is possible to love moms. If you like celebrating moms, if you, like us, enjoy celebrating moms, why not get them a nice gift like the ones that Aura Frames will give you? Aura Frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos with via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. Craig, my wife has an Aura Frame in her office to use to look at pictures of our kid, which is the most mom way that you can... that you can use the frame, I think, but we bet you can think of other ways to use it.
My mom has an Aura frame that she uses to look at pictures of my kid,
and
also my kid uses it to look at pictures of himself.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, kid tested, mom approved.
From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, and even the friends in your life, every mom loves an Aura frame. Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things, TM. Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com, that's all one word, to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code OVERDUE at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, Andrew.
All right.
So what? I was reading an article, an interview with Gillian Flynn in The Guardian by Oliver Berkman from 2013. And
we love those guys.
It talks about the accusations of misogyny against her work and like where she thinks feminism fits into her work and all that kind of stuff. There's another quote that stood out to me where when she's working on Gone Girl, she had just gotten married and the guy's like, was her experience as a newlywed really so dark? She said, we were really newly married at the time, but part of it is that I'm a grand worst case scenarioist in my personal life. So I was doing a lot of what is marriage? What should it be? What shouldn't it be? The funny thing, I guess, is that my husband ended up being the muse of a book about the worst marriage in the world, because if he hadn't consistently said, don't censor yourself, don't worry about me, then it would never have gotten written.
Mm-hmm.
So the core relationship in Gone Girl is this marriage and the terrible people in it. What are the core relationships? This quote to me spoke like Gillian... like being like, this is what I like to write about, is like strong relationships, and I can just go off the deep end in terms of how bad or whatever they are. So what is at the core of this book?
Yeah, I mean, the main one is the main character, Camille Preaker, who's played by Amy Adams.
In the TV show.
In the book.
In the book.
Camille Preaker and her relationship to her mom, Adora.
Okay. Ooh, Adora.
And... Adora did not adore her child, Camille, at all when she was a child.
Okay.
Camille's originally from this town in Missouri called Wind Gap.
Mm.
And it's kind of a backwater is how it's portrayed in the book and how it's described by Camille, though Camille does not have two nice words to say about literally anybody that she meets ever, including children.
Okay.
It's so relentlessly... miserable to be in the head of this woman.
Are you exclusively in her head? There's no Gone Girl reveal.
No, there's no Gone Girl reveal. No.
Okay, great.
She's a hero girl because you're with her.
The whole time she is. Okay.
It's her relationship with her mother, and to a lesser extent, her relationship with her 13-year-old sister. Camille's in her like mid-30s, something like that.
Okay,
more or less. And she has been gone away from home for a while. And She has been sent back by her editor at this Chicago area newspaper, which I think has some generic name. I think it's called the Daily Post.
Oh, you can't. Okay.
And it's described, and this is the 2006 of it all, as it's described as like one of three Chicago, like
vibrant Chicago papers dailies
that are all like, yeah. We also got three competing papers with twice the staff and cash, says her editor Curry.
Oh man.
As he's trying to come up with the story that'll really break her career and really
the Chicago Sun Sports
the Daily Post into popularity.
Okay.
Yeah, what is the assignment? It's mostly family though. It's mostly family. So Curry says, "Oh, some girl got murdered in Wind Gap." And then months ago some other girl was also murdered there in Wind Gap. So we think it might be a serial murder thing. It's kind of a local town, you got connections. Why don't you go, you break the story wide open. And you'll sell papes.
Gotta sell papes. Okay. It's not for the clicks. It's for the papes.
It's for papes. We're not clicking yet.
All right. Nobody's clicking.
I mean, maybe we're clicking a little bit, but it's not. We're still mostly selling papes.
Okay. Sure. How does this... Do you want to go through plot? Do you want to tell me more about Camille?
We can go through plot.
Okay.
To start. And then we can talk a little bit about Camille.
Sure.
So Camille goes down, and she's very... So the interesting thing about Camille is that she's a bad newspaper reporter. She's bad at her job.
Uh-oh.
And she, early on in the book, is kind of saying, oh, I am bad at my job. Frank Curry thinks I'm a soft touch. Might be because I'm a woman. Might be because I'm a soft touch. So she has a very, you know, hard-boiled sort of old-timey reporter
good life
thing about her, but you learn over the course of the book that she's not exaggerating or being self-deprecating. She really is just like a bad Camille is assigned to the story by her editor Frank Curry.
Sure.
She goes down to Wind Gap. She is going to stay with her mother, who is immediately kind of a distant, like the first impression you get of her is just that she's like a distant like the kind of stereotype of a rich mother who didn't have like the time for you as a kid or liked your sibling better. And just like you have a bad relationship, and maybe we'll spend the book repairing that relationship or examining it more. Like it's, you know, it's pretty, I don't want to say by the book, but it's a recognizable thing.
Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What were you going to say?
Oh, just that I think it was also that vulture piece that talked about both sharp objects and dark places being a little more like, if you're reading Gone Girl and then going back, you will find the prior books a bit more straightforward than Gone Girl.
Yeah, there's no I mean, I guess there's kind of a twist when you find out who does it, but there we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get there. But it's definitely like, it's late in the book, and it's, if you have any familiarity with kind of mystery books or like crime procedural kind of things,
yeah,
you'll kind of see it.
I also think that comment is also meant to talk about like the structure of Gone Girl has all of those diary entries in it and things like this. And this is,
yeah, that's
this
fair,
seems
yeah.
a bit more of a like, here's a character going to a place. She engaging in gothic tropes and her family stuff. Like plenty of books start this way and look like this.
This gets broken up a couple times by like newspaper articles that she files, but mostly those are, you just see her kind of picking through the interviews and insights that she does manage to put together and like assembling them into a, like an okay story for a newspaper.
Cool.
So Camille is kind of going around town. There's some people she knows from high school. There are some people who are her mom's friends. She has like uniformly bad things to think about literally every single one of them. But she starts trying to figure out like, are these murders of these two girls, Anne and Natalie are the two girls.
Mm-hmm.
Are they related? Who do the police think did it? Who can I get on the record about this? Like, how can I, Curry thinks that this is going to be good for the paper. He thinks that this is going to be a big story for me. Because he feels like I'm not quite meeting my potential as a reporter.
Mm.
So how do I do that? How do I break this thing?
Okay.
So she's, we learn that the two girls were kind of, so this, maybe we should have started earlier in the book with this, but we're going to talk about like murder. There's going to be some talk about like self-harm. So yeah, if that's stuff that you don't like, then I can tell you that Sharp Objects is not a book for you.
Sure. Yeah.
If you weren't already like turned off of it for some other reason.
If you'd not heard of all the awful things in Gone Girl either. Yeah.
But yeah, these girls had been like lured away by somebody and like played with for a little while and then killed, and then somebody yanks all their teeth out.
Ew.
So there does seem to be a similar MO. And also both of the girls, like they had moved in from out of town and they'd had some kind of trouble wherever it was that they'd come from, like some kind of violent altercation with another kid in whatever like school environment they had been in before.
So some sort of overlap in their profiles.
So Camille is trying to work the police officers, both the local guy and then also this guy for this big city slicker from Kansas City named Richard, who she does sleep with, even though he won't give her really any. She's sleeping with the source and not really getting a lot out of him, like source wise. So, you know, it's kind of.
Yeah, like, does losing, that reinforce losing, the trope or not?
Losing both ways, I guess.
Okay.
And as we are kind of learning a little bit more about the circumstances of the murders, we're also learning a little bit more about Camille. And okay. Like maybe a quarter of the way through, a third of the way through the book, it become like we find out that she is a cutter. She cuts herself. And that's kind of the literal sharp object that the book is like the title refers to is when she was a teenager, she'd started kind of carving words into her skin.
Okay.
And she kept doing that for years and years and years until like basically from neck down, except for like her hands and her face and stuff. She's just like covered in words. And the thing that Flynn does to highlight that is often when Camille is like in a situation, she will feel buzzing in her skin, like a contextually appropriate word.
Oh, okay.
Oh yeah. A scene where Camille is like with her mother, like trying on dresses.
Okay.
In a store and kind of being like lightly humiliated a little bit. The word belittle burns on her right hip. She can just like feel that she knows all the words that she's carved into herself, and she kind of can like feel the prickles on her skin where that word is when something is happening that kind of makes her think of it. It's an interesting literary device. I do think, like, unfortunately, my first thought was of the Jared Leto Joker with damaged written on his forehead.
Well, he ruined a lot of stuff. That is not Gillian. We cannot blame the Jared Leto Joker on Gillian Flynn.
No, we can't.
We can blame him squarely on Jared Leto.
Like, yeah, this character has a lot of trauma, and it's spelled out on her skin literally in words, and it did make me think of the damaged Joker.
No! Unfortunately. Okay, that's interesting. All right.
Yeah, it is interesting, and it's a point of like she Camille feels like she's got something to hide from everybody because she doesn't want that generally known that she like does this to herself.
Yeah,
and her mother
sure.
also like belittles her for having done this to herself. So we find this out about Camille. We find out that Camille had a sister who died when she was young, and that her mom Adora spent all of her time and attention on this child rather than on Camille. She has another sister who's even younger, whose name is Amma, who's about 13. And Camille's relationship with her, they're a little bit strangers, but also Camille kind of finds herself comparing Amma to Marion, her dead sister, a little bit.
Okay.
It's also clear that Adora has never really gotten over Marion in any real way. Like Marion's room is still kind of as it was when she was home and she was sick. So Camille slowly uncovers that her mother had a connection to the murdered girls. Had displayed an interest in them at some point. And as she is, those are kind of setting up facts.
Okay.
I guess I think the easiest thing to do is just to get into the who did it all.
Okay, great.
So is that what you want to do?
Spoilers.
So we find out that Amma and Camille bond kind of at a weird teen party where Amma gives Camille because Amma's like she's a cool mean girl. She's a popular girl. She's a little it girl.
Okay, great.
And Camille, like, to hang out with her sister and also kind of latently because she wants to be in with the popular crowd in like some part of her mind, Camille lets her 13-year-old sister give her like ecstasy.
Oh no.
And like alcohol and stuff. And they both have a night out where they like the walls kind of fall down and it seems like they're bonding a little bit.
Okay.
And then they wake up the next morning, both of them feeling very bad. And Adora is like taking care of them both. And Camille is just like very, like she takes this medicine that Adora gives her and she's just like, she gets very sick. Like she feels worse after Adora has tried to take care of her. And she starts to put two and two together with like how her sister Marion was sick all the time. And she finally goes to the hospital where Marion had been and harangues people until she, like, she can be a good reporter when she wants to. She like harangues people till she gets the medical records for her sister. And in this big fat folder is like a bunch of tests. Like each year that goes by, Marion seems worse than the year before. And then she finds this note from this nurse that's like, I'd really, really think that there's nothing wrong with this girl. Her mom's relationship with her is really weird. She seems to dote over her when she's sick and not care about her when she isn't sick. And I really, really strongly recommend getting this girl away from her mother.
Wonderful.
And Camille meets with the nurse and the nurse is like, yeah, at the time that this was all happening, which I guess like timeline wise probably would have been sometime in like the early 90s or possibly the 80s, depending on how old people were. Just like you couldn't really accuse a parent of doing that kind of stuff to their children.
Certainly not in this town or whatever.
Yeah, because people just get upset and like nobody would believe you and it was an easy way to get fired.
Sure.
But talking about like Munchausen syndrome by proxy.
Yep. Yep,
being the big thing that she suspected that Adora had with Marion,
and that sounds like it's happening again or a version of it.
Yeah, and so Camille puts together like, okay, not only did Adora have a relationship with these two girls who ended up dead, but also Adora probably poisoned
Marion,
her other daughter, to death.
Okay.
And there's a whole very chaotic sequence where Camille sleeps with the main. I think this is before she finds out about the Marion thing, but she's like slept with the brother of Natalie, I think, like the brother of one of the murdered victims, who Richard, the policeman, has kind of led on that they think is the prime suspect.
Okay.
Even though he hasn't been arrested yet, I don't know why. If you had evidence on it, it just seems like you would arrest him. You know, I don't know. It's weird that he hasn't been arrested yet.
Weird.
But there's this big chaotic sequence where Camille goes to like tell Richard what she thinks is happening, and she also finds out that Richard had already been to this hospital, had already asked a bunch of questions about Mary, and already had been like. Had Adora as a prime suspect and just hadn't wanted to tell Camille, both because he wanted to sleep with Camille, but also because he didn't know how Camille felt about Adora and like whether they were
cool.
too close and whether it would mess up the investigation.
Okay.
And yeah, so there's this whole chaotic like final sequence where Camille goes back home and just like spitefully lets Adora poison her some more. I think this is all kind of in the Camille as still desiring her mom's like attention, Camille's like penchant for hurting herself. Like it's all kind of wrapped up in the same thing.
Yeah.
But the, you know, as she's in this like cycle of like vomiting in the tub basically, and the cops break in and arrest Adora because Adora has all these drugs in her possession that she's not supposed to have. And she has some like tweezers that had blood of Anne and Natalie on them. And boy, it does just seem like Adora killed not just Natalie, but or not just Marion, but also Natalie and Anne, these other two little girls who.
It does seem like that.
Does seem like that. Does seem like that. So that's like the first big twist.
Okay.
And that gets you most of the way to the end of the book.
Okay. You've said some things that make me think that Richard might not be an upstanding dude.
He's not an upstanding dude, but that's kind of the end of him.
Okay.
As a character in the book. Well, he sees Camille in the tub with all the words cut all over her skin, and he like loses her number after that. So he's he's a bad guy because of the sleeping with her thing, but also because of that. But also like Camille sucks in that relationship too. So like everybody's kind of doing stuff they probably should not be doing.
Sure. Sure. You said first twist though.
Yeah. There's another twist. Yes. Okay. So, Camille goes back to Chicago, with Amma, who she's going to raise now because she's this girl's sister, and they've kind of got like a little bit of a bond going. But then Amma's at school, and she makes friends with a girl, and the girl's hanging out all the time. And then suddenly this girl gets murdered and all her teeth are yanked out. And Amma's been building this like model of the house down in Wind Gap this whole time. And Camille realizes that the tiles of the floor in Amma's room and the model are all kid teeth.
No.
And actually it was Amma who killed Anne and Natalie because Adora had shown an interest in them, and Amma got jealous, and Amma and her little like group of horrible mean girlfriends killed them. And then after she moved to Chicago, she thought Camille was being too friendly with this girl from school.
No.
And then she killed the girl from school also. So it ended up being Amma doing it.
How does the book end?
And the book ends with like Camille being... like Camille has a break because of this revelation, and she like runs and grabs a sharp object and starts like just jabbing it into her skin. And then she ends up kind of being committed. And then Curry and Curry's wife end up sort of taking responsibility for her, and she lives with them, but she's not a reporter anymore. And she's like not really a functioning member of society really anymore, but she's living with the Currys and doing okay. And that is the end of the book. Like kind of doing okay. And
what happened to her sister?
She gets thrown into juvie, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. At least until she's 18, probably for longer. Hopefully for longer. She did kill a lot of people.
Oh my God.
So, yeah, it is really like it's kind of an interestingly structured book. I think there are some interesting character things happening and some interesting devices that are being deployed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just I found hanging out with Camille so unpleasant. And then the things that happen in the book are so dark and unpleasant on top of that.
Sure.
I just had a rough read. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, that's fine. I've had rough reads before.
Yeah,
I get it.
Here's things why I didn't have a great read of this book is Camille's very judgmental of everybody who she meets. Mm-hmm. And in a way that feels so gratuitous and petty. I feel like if I met Camille Preaker, she would immediately assume like six unflattering things about me and then discard me and never think about me again. So here's her rolling up to the house of some people whose daughter was murdered so she can interview one of them for her story about how their daughter was murdered.
Great.
This is the beginning of chapter 2.
Okay.
Happy hour. I gave up on the search and stopped off at Futh's, the town's low-key country bar, before dropping by 1665 Grove Street, home of Betsy and Robert Nash, parents of Ashley 12, Tiffany 11, the deceased Anne, forever 9, and 6-year-old Bobby Jr. Bear in mind that this, Camille's not been back in this town in forever. She doesn't really know any of these people. So this is all just a story about these people that Camille has invented in her head. Three girls until at last their baby boy. As I sipped my bourbon and cracked peanuts, I pondered the growing desperation the Nashes must have felt each time a child popped out without a penis. There was the first, Ashley, not a boy, but sweet and healthy. They'd always wanted two anyway. Ashley got a fancy name with the extravagant spelling and a closet full of frosting cake dresses. They crossed their fingers and tried again, but still got Tiffany. Now they were nervous, the welcome home less triumphant. When Mrs. Nash got knocked up once again, her husband bought a tiny baseball glove to give the lump in her belly a nudge in the right direction. Imagine the righteous dismay when Anne arrived. She got slapped with some family name, didn't even get the extra E to ornament it a bit. Thank goodness for Bobby. 3 years after the disappointing Anne, was he an accident or one last shot of Brio? Bobby was given his dad's name, was doted on, and the little girl suddenly realized how extraneous they were, especially Anne. No one needs a third girl, but now she's getting some attention. Well, and then she meets she pulls up to the house, and she says, the Nash's house, as much as I expected, a late 70s piece of generica, like all the houses on the west side of town. One of those homely ranch houses featuring the garage as its central point. As I drove up, a messy blonde boy was sitting in the driveway in a big wheel, several sizes too small for him, grunting with the effort to pedal the plastic bike. The wheels just spun in place under his weight. "Want to push?" I said as I got out of the car. I'm not good with children as a rule, but it seemed an attempt wouldn't hurt. He looked at me silently for a second, stuck a finger in his mouth. His tank top slipped up as his round belly popped out to greet me. Bobby Jr. looked stupid and cowed. A boy for the Nashes, but a disappointing one. My name's Camille Preaker. I'm a Cracker Jack reporter from the big city, and I'm going to roll up to this stupid fat kid's house. I'm going to talk to his parents about his dumb murdered sister.
Here's
her meeting someone else later. Brad Brucker was the type of husband to live where Katie said, impregnate Katie when she asked, buy Katie the Pottery Barn sofa she wanted, and otherwise shut up. He was good looking if you looked at him long enough, and he had a dick the size of my ring finger. Camille, would you just like cool it with everybody for a second?
Whoa.
As soon as she pulled up in front of the house, I realized that Katie Lacey, now Katie Brucker, had predictably done well for herself. I knew this both from the fact that it took her 5 minutes to pick me up. Turns out her home was but a block away, and what she picked me up in? One of those huge, stupid SUVs that cost more than some people's homes and provide just as many comforts. Behind my head, I could hear the DVD player tittering with some kid's show despite the absence of kids. It's just so unrelenting, the unpleasantness of this woman and everything.
And whose like head you're in is like, that's like the big issue for you.
Constantly. Yeah. There's another scene later where she's getting some crucial information about who did it. And she's like, a nurse wrote a note about something, and she's imagining the nurse as some like, you know, big old busty, like, you know, takes no nonsense, big brash and bold, brassy lady. And then she meets her and she's nothing like Camille expected, and it's like, Camille, I wish to God that everybody you met could make you have that reaction for just a moment, just like make you maybe think about the assumptions that you're having about every single person that you meet forever.
I'm wondering if seeing this portrayed by an actor would work better for you.
Maybe, I don't know.
If only because you could then be like, that's a person over, in the same way that like you weren't as frustrated being in Nick's head and not having access to whether or not he'd murdered his
wife. I think maybe as long as there wasn't a scene where she was like writing in her diary about like every stupid kid that she met, and we like had to hear that read aloud to us in like voiceover or something. As long as that wasn't happening, yeah, probably it wouldn't be as big a deal. But I give you this preface about how unpleasant I found Camille to kind of inform how little slack I was willing to cut her when she almost immediately begins doing the unethical female journalist trope. So there has been a lot of writing about this. The one I like the most is one from 2018 in The Atlantic called The Lazy Trope of the Unethical Female Journalist by Sophie Gilbert, which I think came like the news hook for this was the Sharp Objects TV show.
Okay. Cool.
But she also talks about Zoe Barnes from the Netflix House of Cards show.
Okay.
Rory Gilmore from the 2016 Gilmore Girls reboot. Basically just talking about how all of these journalists are really bad at their jobs, and they also sleep with sources and bosses all the time, and they're impossible to take seriously. And actually, that's really a damaging trope, and it's not great to have it out there all the time. Gilbert writes, Sarah Lonsdale writes in her 2016 book, The Journalist in British Fiction and Film, that the timing is ironic. As women have increasingly entered journalism and achieved high-level jobs in the industry, their cultural representations have become increasingly negative and stereotyped. You can trace the pattern back at least as far as 1981, when Sally Field played a Miami reporter in the Sidney Pollack movie Absence of Malice. Field's character committed a number of ethical indiscretions, including having an affair with the subject of one of her stories, a liquor wholesaler played by Paul Newman, and publishing off-the-record information that caused a woman to die by suicide. Jokes aside, fictional tropes can have real-world consequences. In her New York story, Kogan pointed out the trend of portraying women reporters as poisonous and promiscuous was creating a toxic environment for real journalists whose professional overtures to sources were frequently mistaken for personal ones. And even though shows such as Sharp Objects aren't intended to offer a serious critique of journalists and their methods, in Camille's case, it's to show how thoroughly she sabotages herself at every turn. These portrayals matter, especially in an environment where Americans trust journalists and their methods less than ever. And then she also links this Toast piece that I'd read before by Danny Ortberg, A Day in the Life of a Fictional Female Reporter. 9:17 a.m., sleep with a source. 10 a.m., sleep with my boss.
Sure.
12:11 p.m., return to source's house for more sex / to steal the incriminating book he keeps locked in his nightstand. 1:03 p.m., naked interview. Camille is just like bathed in the trope of the
sure.
Yeah. So she both ends up sleeping with the like lead officer on the case who's also investigating this murder in Wind Gap, and with somebody who the book really wants us to think is the prime suspect in the murder.
Okay, sure.
She does both of these things like kind of like within the same 48 hours. I think.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's just a book where my read of it was so dominated by how little I like spending time with the only person I spend any time with that it's hard for me to think about anyone else.
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah. I have a quote from glowing review. I don't know. It's this is Hillary Kelly in Vulture. Sharp Objects is the ultimate Gillian Flynn novel. And this is also pegged to the show. Mm-hmm. But spends a lot of time talking about the women in this book and like the relationship to Gone Girl and stuff like that. And the closing graph is, I will never understand where your penchant for ugliness comes from. Adora tut tuts at Camille's career choice. Seems like you have enough of that in life without deliberately seeking it out. And then the writer continues. It's a query lobbed at the reader as well. Why seek out this darkness? Why revel in finally seeing female villains so nasty and loathsome? Everyone wants to see themselves reflected in art, even in our nastiest, most secret little bits. This novel lets us examine all the sharp thoughts in our own heads, but with a layer of protection. Is that just somebody enjoyed this more than you did and you don't have access to that read? Or
It's fine they liked it more than I did. That's fine. I think a lot of people probably will in this case.
Sure. I mean
I don't think the reaction to the book was mostly negative. I think it was mostly positive.
Sure.
And I can't get there at this one. I don't know.
I have some words from folks who had like medium reads.
Oh, really?
If you'd like to hear them.
Not bad reads.
Not bad reads. They are in fact good reads.
Oh wow, okay. So are they 3-star Goodreads reviews?
You're exactly right. That's the exact number of stars.
That's so cool
that
I knew that.
Yeah.
Right off the bat.
First, I have Maria. Maria wrote a lot about the book.
How do you solve a problem like this person and their book review?
I appreciate that Maria used a lot of bolded like one sentence per paragraph to help me like really get the salient points.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was a good. Maria mostly liked the book, I think. but had issues with the twist because it was like, I'm not even sure which twist she's talking about, but that like a lot of it was didn't land for her. She says it was a good plot twist buried by the writing and presentation. To sum up, it was a good but not great mystery thriller to me. If you enjoy mystery thrillers that depend mostly on abusive relationships and character studies, you will like this a lot more.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. I think my issue with it as a twist is like by the time... So you spent a lot of time with Camille's transparently horrible mother and her capricious, transactional, manipulative little sister.
Yes.
And so by the time you get to the point... The only question in my mind by the time you get to the point where like, oh, it's Camille's family that did it basically is like, am I being faked out because the book so obviously wanted me to think that these people were terrible the whole time?
Yeah, you know what I mean? Sure.
Like,
sure.
It's, by the time it becomes clear that it is Adora, and then after that, it becomes clear that it's also Amma, because Adora did kill Marion. Like, Amma had nothing to do with that. She was not
born. Yeah.
There were, I think some, when you have a mystery where you're trying to do like a real whodunit thing, like a real mystery,
mm-hmm.
I think there do need to be multiple plausible suspects. And by the time you get to Adora and Amma being the culprits, the book has spent so little time like convincingly setting up anybody else.
Sure.
That if it like... It would have the same impact if like suddenly a drifter came through at the end and it just like happened to be some random like happenstance. It gets like into- that's a sad. That's a, if you blamed it on any other named character in the book, that's how satisfying it would be because the book had spent so little time building up anybody else.
Sure. Yeah.
On
and
the
so
possible
it's like,
suspects list.
It's dipping its toe into whodunit territory, but that's not the way that it's presenting itself. Right. Like Gone Girl has like whodunit elements to it where it's like once you know that she is responsible, then you're like, oh, well, how did that work? What did she, what was she doing? What was her goal?
I don't even know that I'm saying it's a whodunit. I'm saying it's a whodunit, but it's not giving
enough
like plausible options for who could have done it that it's interesting to find out who did it or like particularly surprising to find out who did it.
Yes,
I guess is what
sure.
I mean.
I think I was getting that from you. Yes.
Okay, sure.
I have another one from Brady, that just says, WTF did I just read? 3 stars.
Okay.
That's the we all know Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. Did I just read?
Was there more to the review than that?
No, that's literally the whole text of the review.
All right. I can sympathize with that one. Yeah.
And then I have what sounds like more than a 3-star review from someone here. It says Roxanne Gay? Actual Roxanne Gay?
Is this real Roxanne Gay?
Yes. I believe so.
Or just a Roxanne Gay.
No, it has like a whole like author page and everything linked to it.
Dang.
So
okay.
I love Sharp Objects as much as I love Gone Girl. Camille is an amazing protagonist, utterly believable, well drawn, and I related to her far more than makes me feel comfortable admitting. This is a book about darkness and women, and Flynn is one of those writers who stares down darkness and goes even further. Just like Gone Girl, though, the ending is ludicrous. I laughed out loud because it was just too much. Completely bananas. I figured it out early on and don't mind that it ended where I expected, but the last few chapters are just, let's throw everything ridiculous at the reader and see what sticks. So there's that. Anyway, still awesome book.
Yeah, yeah. Also, I see my read in that summary as well.
I was just scrolling through looking for like different takes, and then I was like, wait, what?
Is that Roxanne Gay?
Is that Roxanne Gay? It's like encountering like a FAMO at a bar. You're just like,
a FAMO.
A FAMO.
Is that one of the interns from Bones? Like who I saw at the Rittenhouse Christmas thing a couple years ago? A real FAMO.
Did I just see Dermot Mulroney somewhere? Well, thanks for going back into the Flynn mines for us, Andrew.
Yeah, I wish I had a better read because I do like Gone Girl. I do like Gillian Flynn.
Yes.
I just was not, I guess, I don't know if it's just like a function of like, I was like traveling a lot and I was a little sick and I had these other stuff on my mind. So I didn't have a lot of like brain capacity for being forgiving of a, but I feel like I know when I don't like a character in a book. Like I've done this like yelling about a point of view thing before a couple of times. I feel like Gillian Flynn deserves it less maybe than some of the other books that I've done this to.
I have not heard you yell about craft at all. I have not heard you yell about, like, it seems mostly like you just did not want to spend time with this person that Gillian Flynn, like, was interested in writing about.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just, you know, sometimes people have different interests.
And okay. I can recognize the it is interesting to do an unlikable woman, especially in 2006, when it's still kind of a new and like developing thing. It's interesting to do the like hard boiled, hard drinking reporter archetype, but make it a woman. Like these are interesting spaces to play in.
The quote, there's a New York Times article from 2018, again pegged, I think, to the show and to the film Widows, talking about sharp objects in this paragraph. These days, this is by Lauren Euler. These days, representations of the messy lives of flawed women, those are messy and flawed are in quotes, are celebrated as indications of a multifaceted portrayal of the gender. Though sharp objects didn't garner much critical attention in 2006, when, as Flynn says, the biggest conflict female protagonist faced was, can she get the boy and can she get the shoes and she's had a Cosmo again. Over the summer, it became a relentlessly dissected limited series starring Amy Adams. So she's definitely writing and thinking about this book, or at least reflected on it, in the context of Sex and the City.
It made me want to look up when the movie The Devil Wears Prada came out, and exactly 2006 is when that movie came out. So I feel,
people like Miranda Priestley, though, the mean lady in that movie as well. Mm-hmm. People like mean ladies sometimes, right?
Yeah, no, people like mean, like people like to be stepped on by mean ladies.
Okay, let's.
Ugly Betty, also 2006. Just thinking about like pratfall based.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, if you, the listener, have recommendations for characters that Andrew might want to spend time with more, you can send us an email, overduepod. And I don't mean that sarcastically. I mean actual characters that you think Andrew would enjoy hanging out with. Don't send him more Camilles, please. Don't do that. Overduepod@gmail.com or overduepod on Instagram, Blue Sky, find us on social media. Our theme song was composed by Nick Larangis. Andrew, if folks want to know more about the show, where do they go?
OverduePodcast.com is our internet website where we post our schedule for the coming month. We've got a schedule for May that I'm going to let Craig read for you in a second. We've also got a link to our Patreon page, patreon.com/overduepod. Support the show financially. Get access to our Discord. People have been doing voice chats, like a kind of a voice chat book club thing lately, which I think is a cool way to use the platform. Mm-hmm. And obviously everybody's talking about Garfield all the time.
Yep.
Sometimes people make a comment, the kind of an offhand comment about the movie Shrek, and then have to do an iOS notes apology.
Yeah, because just members of the Discord, not anybody definitely affiliated with the podcast.
Just
or
people in the Discord, in the Overdue Discord. But if you want to know more about what we're talking about, you're just gonna have to join patreon.com/overduepod. You also get bonus episodes and other stuff early. It's not all Garf.
No, in fact,
a lot of it's Garf, but not all Garf.
We just did Think and Grow Rich as a bonus episode with some of our patrons. That is up for some patrons now, and we'll be hitting the main feed in a few weeks. So if you'd like that without waiting, patreon.com/overduepod.
Yeah. So, Craig, what are you going to be reading next week? And then what are we both going to be reading throughout the rest of the month of May, in the month that where the flowers have been brought by the showers? May.
Here
it's going to be May, Craig.
We're going to celebrate Children's Book Week with A Bear Called Paddington by Michael Bond. I, Robot by Isaac Asimov will follow. Then Sing Unburied Sing by Jesmyn Ward. And then Percy Jackson number 4 by Rick Riordan in my list.
Boy, you
here.
Didn't, have, you didn't, little, you, we've didn't, done the, we did this for the Patreon episode the other night, and you also didn't have the exact name to hand.
The Battle of the Labyrinth.
All right. Bet there's going to be some Minotaurs.
I hope there are Minotaurs. And also, some more episodes of our Stop Homer Time Iliad series will be on the main feed. Check it out.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. If you like sharp objects more than me, I am really sorry. And I hope that my not enjoying the book has not taken anything away from you. I think that we're all mature enough here to have different reactions to the same work and still have a perfectly functional parasocial relationship. I'm going to try hard to like the next one more.
Yeah,
that's my commitment to you.
Just show up and be yourself every time, which you do. That's all you can do.
But I'm not going to say I'm any more fun to hang out with the Camille Preaker sometimes.
Well,
probably drink less. Honest,
I think you probably are more fun to hang out with than her. Huh. I know you, and I keep hanging out with you.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's true. You do. All right. Until we talk to you next week, everybody, please try to be happy.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.